and your early education, where your family came from, it's not Wisconsin and so forth.
Yes, well, I'm native born, but I'll go back to the family origins, which are German. My father's family were German 48ers, with all that implies, and they came from the Leipzig area in Germany. And typical immigrant crossing up the Erie Canal and through the lakes, sailing vessel, into Lake Michigan, and their landfall was at Manitowoc, which then was a very modest little port, perhaps not even identified as such. And they moved or settled in, not as farmers, but as artisans, really, in what was then the village, and still is a village, of Manitowoc Rapids. It's west of the city of Manitowoc, and it hasn't changed much since then. It's a crossroads. But they settled because of the water power. The fall line of the river was there.
I see.
So there was a mill and other power takeoffs. The Runge great-grandfather must have been relatively old as an immigrant, because really all I know about him was that, along with his generalized liberal political beliefs, had been an impressed soldier of Napoleon, which must push him back, you see, in
age. Oh,
yeah.
Would have to.
And he didn't live long in this country. The maternal great-grandfather, Gottlieb Hintze,
how do you spell that?
H-I-N-T-Z-E. Was the village cabinet maker. Made all his own tools, had been thoroughly trained as a mechanic artisan in Germany. Made his tools and made furniture, and I suppose some carpentry. We have a few pieces left of his work, which is this beautiful turn of or mid-century walnut construction. And the little house that he built is there on the banks of the river. So these people, I emphasize the political because it has, I think, some kind of genetic, in quotation marks, relationship to my own interests. They were fervent, 48ers, I think originally of Catholic background, but really their religious activity was closer to the Freie Gemeinde group that you found in the Sauk Prairie of these German 48ers. They were not established church. And were Democrats right off. And early on formed part of the constituency of Bryan Democrats in the state. That was E.G. Ryan, later Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Court. And to the young and to the people of that era was kind of the La Follette of the time, the liberal Democrat. Well, nothing too spectacular in all of that, except on my father's side. There were two sons, my grandfather, Frederick, who later became a dentist, unlettered, mind you, apprenticed dentist, and he did this after a fling at being a sailor. He sailed on the Great Lakes as a youth, was shipwrecked in Lake Superior, was saved, almost unbelievably, decided that the waters were not for him. His brother, Carl, for whom I'm named only in part, was an activist who went west to homestead land in the Dakotas to teach school, which he did, and sold out, and later came back as a mature sort of student to the UW Law School. And he was, Carl Runge, graduated in the class of 86. And for many years when I was around, even on the faculty, he kept returning as the oldest returning alumnus and so on. And eventually, Carl Runge was the lawyer of the piece and was a circuit judge in Milwaukee from very early on, about 1905 or so until post-World War II. And so, in many respects, my great uncle was my contact with the family background. And political activist, and of course, a good, he'd been city attorney in Milwaukee and a good judge. And was, I think, the last judge in Milwaukee that would try lawsuits in German.
Oh.
And people like Jake Boischer, who I think you may or may not have known, colleague in law school, his father, a lawyer in Milwaukee, used to try cases before Judge Carl Rumer. Well, my father and his brother, like their father, were dentists, but they, you know, it was further down the years, did, my father was a graduate of Marquette. And the other brother practiced dentistry in Houghton, Michigan, for many years. Then, on my mother's side, this was the next wave of migration, post-Civil War. They were North Germans out of Pomerania, near Stettin, and they too were, well, there was no political interest. If any political interest they had was of a very conservative nature, I'm sure both at home and here. But my grandfather, who was an immigrant, had been trained as a Mason in Germany, and was a Mason in the Green Bay area, in my little hometown of Seymour, which is Outagamie County. Until he and his carpenter friend, William Miller, decided that walking out 6 miles to build houses and walk home 6 miles in the evening really wasn't going to get them very far. And they became associated in business, and my mother's family business name was Miller-Peel, and they ran retail lumber yards in the Seymour area, a string of them, and had a big shop, carpentry, cabinet shop, and most importantly, had a fair-sized timber cutting venture in the north. Now, they weren't lumber barons, they were lesser...
much smaller scale.
Smaller scale, but still reasonably substantial. And their headquarters up there was at Gagen, now a ghost town, really, east of Rhinelander, where there was the big mill. And it lasted until the Depression days, and I was fortunate enough to see it as a boy in the summers. It was very exciting, a real, honest-to-God, company timber town with the bunkhouses and the barns and the kitchens and the company store and all that went with this. And so my earliest association with the North was to visit the family establishment in the North. Well, as I indicated, my father practiced dentistry in Seymour, married my mother there, and I lived there. There's still my mother's family people up there until I came to the university. Typical small Midwestern Wisconsin non-county seat, smaller than that community.
Did you attend a one-room schoolhouse?
No, I didn't, because we lived in the municipality, and so I went to a multi-room schoolhouse, and my father was on the school board, and despite the Depression years, and in part because of the Depression, I think it was a PWA grant that built a new high school with, you know, modern facilities. But a reasonably good school, because in these German communities, education was important, and people like my father and the school board, they hired good people, so that the staff was good, and I think reasonably successful under their high school education. But ours was a very political household. This 48er influence carried through, and my father was an active La Follette progressive. And this was the same era in which you had then in the La Follette movement professional people, high school superintendents, doctors, dentists, lawyers in these small towns. For example, my father was not a close friend, but an acquaintance at least of Gaylord Nelson's father, who was up at Clear Lake.
See,
these were the people that made up the real heart of progressivism. And that's in part why it was successful. None of these people, many at least, were looking for anything themselves. They had their own careers, but they were kind of super citizens in terms of their political behavior. And so, for example, when it became a question as to where I was going to go to college, and I should say on high school era and so on, I was active in everything, and fair athlete, speech, debate, student government, the whole panoply of small school activities. My father, because he never really told me anything directly, I guess he did tell me one thing. I had flirted with the idea of going to West Point.
Oh, that's quite different from Wisconsin, isn't it?
Quite different, but it also kind of relates to my later interest in military affairs.
Why did this interest you?
I don't know, really. I guess it must have been my reading of American history. And I found the academy and the professional military and all this kind of exciting. Well, anyhow, my father was quite firm on this point.
I see.
You see, he hadn't been a soldier, the other members of the family hadn't been, and he didn't want any professional militarism in the household. On the other hand, very strong, you see, that really the only place to be was UW-Madison. Well, we didn't call it UW-Madison, it was the university.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, was most encouraging and delighted that I came here. Now, as I say, on my father's side, no organized church. My mother's family, and she in particular, very devout North German Lutherans.
I would have guessed that might be it.
You see, didn't cause any particular conflict, but they each followed their own cultural lineage.
Mm.
And, of course, I was in school, kid, in the Depression years. Not that this ever affected me. We were quite well off. Not that my father made a great deal of money professionally. A substantial, relatively substantial income. And my mother's family and her inheritance and so on was modestly adequate. So I can't claim any hardships at all. Never.
You must have been aware.
I observed it because we had in our small community people who were in deep, deep trouble. And the farm community and the kids that came in from the rural areas, particularly in high school, you see, I knew about it. And if I hadn't known about it, my father would have seen to that I knew about it. You know, he was, of course, a great Roosevelt admirer and friend of Phil and Bob, and you know that whole kind of exciting politics of the 30s. Now, does that give you a fill-in on kind of family background?
Yes, it does. It makes quite clear that there was never any real question about whether you would or would not attend a college.
No.
And merely where you would go, and being a Wisconsin boy, it seemed logical that you would have
gone. My sister, who was 4 years older, went to Lawrence.
Well, she did.
Which was close at hand, and she was a music major, and of course that was one of the best music schools in the Midwest. But my interests were quite different, and I came down then in the fall of 38 and lived in Tripp Hall in the university dormitories, and in that period you had the bright, imaginative kids from good families, not rich families, but good, substantial families from all over the state living in Tripp and Adams Hall. And some of my oldest friends were met right there. For example, Matt Heffernan.
Oh, yes.
Who, about to be Chief Justice, came down from Sheboygan. Really good class, just for what that's worth, I think.
Was it a large class?
Well, the classes weren't that big then, you know, but nonetheless, it was 1,500, or it must have been.
Oh, that's big in my thinking.
But just a couple of the people, Bob Lampman, Leon Epstein was a year ahead of us, and most of them, Matt Heffernan, Burley Jacobs, Dick Leonard, editor of the Journal.
Well, these are all names that sound familiar to me.
Yeah, and we've had just a John Reynolds, sometime governor, justice. Interesting people. Well, let's see. Leon's particular friend was, I'm getting old and trouble with names, you know, the NBC, Ed Newman. Ed was.
He was in that class?
No, not a year ahead of us.
Oh.
Arthur Nielsen, later my roommate, the market research crowd, you know, who ran the fundraising for the foundation this year, was a year ahead. But we're very close friends. One of our class turned out to be Walter Mirisch, the big one of the Hollywood Waddells. And that very bright guy. See, we used to get, well, this first-rate students and friends-to-be that came out of the Jewish community in New York.
Oh, yes.
Which was part of that pattern. What's his name? I'm having trouble with his name. Kind of an impresario in television and movies and all this stuff. But you see, we had mostly Wisconsin people, but a few very able non-resident kids that we mingled into our groups, and we all became good friends and associates. And even though the class was big, for those of us who were activists, it was just about the right size. Lampman and I, for example, Lampman was president of the Wisconsin Union, I was president of the Wisconsin Student Association, and Matt was vice president, and we all had offices up in the old Union, and they really sort of halcyon days.
Sounds it.
Because the war was looming and it started in Europe. I was an American Institutions major when that was a new and first-rate program, because the very best people in the social studies departments participated. My advisor was Sally Perlman. And, you know, you had available for courses some of our best here, who in turn were some of the best in the country. Salig and Ed Witte, Harold Groves, and Bill Heseltine, American historian.
It's him I knew.
And the and then sort of the Western historian John Hicks, who left shortly during the war and went to be dean of the graduate school at Berkeley. I took a course as a sort of tryout, beginning law student. And Lloyd Garrison, and then the young Willard Hurst, who had just come from Harvard. So, when we were being intellectually serious, which wasn't too often, but occasionally, this superb social studies faculty that we availed ourselves of. And so I really, you know, one tends to overly romanticize usually one's undergraduate education. But really, reciting the names suggests that there is great quality in the instruction.
Well, the names, many of the names you've mentioned, I'm familiar with, and they were outstanding people from everything I've heard.
It was, while we were in school, or just before that Ed Witte, for example, structured and the whole Social Security program. So, and of course we had our people heavily involved in the emerging labor movement of the 30s. And social programs and so on, both at the Washington scale and in Phil La Follette's administration in Wisconsin. So that sort of this Wisconsin idea, the university interface with government, this was one of its peak periods of activity and influence. And it left a mark on many of us. Certainly Lampman is a fine example of that. Lampman came down from Plover. So we were from little towns and a few from Milwaukee, all around the state. Well, undergraduate years, as I said, they were halcyon days and gave us very real intellectual inspiration. And almost, I think I'd have to say kind of political morality or a political philosophy from men like Witte, who sent us out charged, you know, to to pay our debt. And then there were student activities. I was president of the student association.
How did that come about?
Well, I've forgotten now. I think there were four members elected as sophomores to the board, and you served then in your junior and senior year. And I was a candidate and won one of the four seats. Matt Heffernan was another. And then the election of the president and the vice president came from within the board. So
it just followed.
Yeah. I belonged to a fraternity. I think it's sort of an unusual one, which was a Sigma Phi group out in Prospect Avenue. They lived, and they still do, in the old Bradley house, you know.
Harold Bradley house?
Yeah, on Prospect.
Oh, yes, I know the house.
And one of the reasons it was also beautifully restored was that Arthur Nielsen Sr. Did it. All of us contributed money, but Big Arthur, what in the hundreds of thousands, you see.
Wasn't there a fire there?
There was a fire, yeah.
Yes, that's what I thought.
That restored it. Well, it was a small group, we thought select, but at least small, and good men. And my particular friend out of that era was Arthur Nielsen Jr. And of course, the Nielsen's father and son have done a great deal for this institution. Not just building tennis stadia and so on, but as I said, Arthur Jr. was chairman this year of the UW Foundation's fund drive and so on. And those friendships have maintained over the years. Well, but the halcyon days ended. I guess that's a fair summary of undergraduate years. active, first-rate intellectual exposure, some of it took, and but I was also an ROTC. Now
that's a story in itself, your continuing interest with that.
Yeah.
I think we should get back to your later work with that.
Yeah. So I was commissioned in June of 42.
Well, the war was already
going
on.
Came on
and we were
the war
in
came
it.
On in December, and we, of course, stayed on to complete our academic work and get our commissions. So, June of 42 arrived, and I went on active duty almost immediately within the month, and my first duty station was out at wonderful western post of Fort Francis E. Warren, Wyoming. It's outside of Cheyenne for first level of military schooling and training. I'd never been west before, and an exciting experience. Particularly this old army post, you know, which smacked of the Indian days. Though I think it was probably established somewhat later, and probably was a fairly good-sized post because Francis E. Warren was chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
And incidentally, the father of Jack Pershing's first wife.
Oh.
So it wasn't all Pershing's ability that carried into lofty heights. I guess I went from there to the Philadelphia Depot in Philadelphia. And this was my first experience in big urban places. Philadelphia wasn't as ugly as it is today, in social terms. And I served there for about 9 months. It was, again, a kind of exciting period because Arthur Nielsen was down at Fort Belvoir. No, not at Belvoir. In Maryland, I can't think of the name of the post. But Nielsen was a great tennis player and had been captain of the UW team and so on. And that, in his general social standing, carried him into the best circles in the East in Philadelphia. And so we again had a lot of fun on the East Coast. For example, we were wartime members of the Marion Cricket Club, one of the really elegant clubs on the main line. And I think they charged us $10 a year or something.
Oh, incredible.
But I was promoted there and went down to the Advanced Quartermaster School at Fort Lee in Virginia. I was kind of lucky because they were mostly senior officers. I was just a first lieutenant. But nonetheless, I was nominated and finished that unit. And then I was turned around again and sent west, way west this time, to Vancouver Barracks, which is on the banks of the Columbia. And this is truly an historic post. It was established...
It was Vancouver, Washington?
Mm-hmm, Vancouver, Washington. It was established in the era in which we were jousting with the British over that northwest frontier, the 54-40 or fight era. And this post had been put in before the Civil War. It was the post that U.S. Grant retired from when he left the Army the first time, or after the Mexican War. And I was commanding a unit. Activated and trained a field depot company. Then this was turned around, physically we were turned around, and thank God we didn't go into the Pacific. We went back east, the Port of New York, and ended up in the UK. Went over on the old QE1 out of New York and settled in staffing the depot in the Midlands that in turn supported the airborne divisions and the troop carrier command. Lovely place, right in Sherwood Forest.
Mm.
I was terribly fortunate in all these assignments, just by chance. In the heart of Sherwood Forest, and I knew it was a good place because the Guards Armored Brigade had the big estates in the area. And we shared. We were on the same estate with the Scots Guards. And my counterpart, I was liaison to the Brits, and my counterpart was a young captain named Balfour. So about the third time I was visiting with him, I asked Balfour if he was, I said, that's a distinguished name. And he said, yes, the Prime Minister was my great uncle. And so we were associated with the very elite of the British Army.
Do you know the rest of his name?
No, I don't. I don't know anymore. The Guards Armored Brigade was the unit that tried to make the breakthrough on that ill-fated operation crossing the rivers and to get to the Rhine, Operation Market Garden. you may have seen that movie.
No, I don't think I did.
Well, they didn't make it. And this is one of Montgomery's failures. Well, we trained our unit hard, and we left England, or left that post on D-Day and headed for the coast of Britain, and went over about D plus 10 or 15, something like that.
Now, how did you get there?
Well, we went over on a small craft, British, I think it was a passenger vessel. Yes, it was, and then went off in small boats and rafts and so on, and
this
landed.
Landing craft type?
Yeah. But mind you, this was no heroic adventure. It was very peaceful. The German resistance had been reduced to some artillery interdiction on the critical road junctions in Normandy by this time. Making up the 12th Army Group. And then occurred the great swing through northern France, the 3rd Army leading the way out and around Brittany and moving, turning and moving.
Was this the Army under Patton?
Yes, 3rd Army was Patton. 1st Army was Hodges, and Bradley commanded the Army Group. So we followed on and took up our next operating station southeast of Paris, and it was in this period in which the armies had really outrun their logistical support, and that's why we had to, all of us had to move up fast and back of them. And supplies were coming off the beaches by truck because the railroads were destroyed, then back on rail, and then forward to the armies. The next movement forward was to the Verdun, where we established, and I became the operations officer, as well as commanding my unit, of this major supply complex for food, rations, or food, gasoline, and ammunition. We supported 3rd Army out of that Verdun operation from roughly September through the next spring. And we were there when the counteroffensive came in on the Ardennes, in the Battle of the Bulge. And Patton, the 3rd Army, mounted their great counteroffensive, and I won't bore you with all the technical detail except to say that Patton is sort of known for the worst side of his military performance in many respects, and not for the best side. That operation was so beautifully planned, and we were all so committed and responsive out of dedication or out of fear, I'm not sure which, that it just wasn't going to fail. And
well, we all know it didn't fail.
And it didn't fail. And Patton made the movement in less time than anyone thought he could, and went right into the counter-offensive. And I saw to it that the trains left Verdun that night, checked them out, and the rail operating unit, we were still using rail, the economy of other transport, to a rail operating unit commanded by a Milwaukee Road guy from South Dakota. And I said, you know, my God, you got to get it there. And he did, of course. And the 1st Armored Division, not 1st, 4th, arrived at Arlon, where the trains were, half an hour after the trains arrived, and they were refueled right off the side of the train. And the 4th Armored Division went into the attack that morning. So, in terms of professional military accomplishment, tactical and logistical, Patton was absolutely superb. And his army by this time and supporting elements had worked together long enough to make it go. Well, then came course, the winter's fighting and the breakthrough into France. And we are into Germany itself, and we moved up to a position on the Rhine, waiting for the big rail bridge to be rebuilt across the Rhine at Mainz. It was done, and we moved on to Würzburg and then Nuremberg, which was our last major operation in Europe. We laid in a open storage depot in the Nazi Party Stadium area, where the Hitler Youth and the Party Faithful used to come every summer. They had all these wonderful campsites and so on. And this tremendous layout of roads and stuff, you see, which we used. And I think I commanded the largest ration depot in the history of the United States Army, because the stuff came in from all over Europe. We concentrated at Nuremberg. So I had about 200 million rations there, more or less. Which would have fed everyone in the country for 2 days. Had a lot of fun. Met friends from the Justice Department. Went through the prisoner dock at the courthouse to see our defeated adversaries sitting in their cells. And sort of passed the summer, shipping in and shipping out and so on. But I went to England on leave, August, September. Went up to see my old friends in the Midlands, in Nottinghamshire. Came back through Oxford just sort of for fun. I hadn't been in Oxford to see it and stay overnight. And by chance ran into a great South African at the Randolph Hotel for dinner. And this is a fairly distinguished family. The name is Bach, like Derek Curtis Bach at Harvard. There, that's all the same family. One brother went to South Africa, and Edward Bach came to the United States. He's, sometime editor of the New York paper, and the Curtis Publishing Company and all that stuff. So Bach said, I understand that there's going to be a party of Americans at Oxford this term. Why the hell don't you join us? I said, well, that's a great idea. I'll check it out. So I went into London the next day and did, and they said you had to be nominated by your major command. So I flew back to Munich and went to Third Army headquarters and talked to the appropriate staff officer. And he said, do we need you, here? I said, no, I have a good executive officer, and you're sending everyone home anyway. And,
this was when, though?
The fall of 45.
Oh, yes. So things were...
Yeah, the war was over, and
over,
so
and
he said, what's your undergraduate education? I told him, and he said, fine, we'll send you. So I left a day and a half later and flew back to England. And as absolute luck would have it, the other Wisconsin type in the group of 75 was Leon Epstein.
Oh, my gracious.
So we had just a superb time. I think I was the senior officer of the group.
What was your rank?
I was a major by then. And we had a nice young lieutenant who was in charge of our administration, but he'd give me his Jeep whenever I wanted it, and we were well paid, and the Army paid Oxford for everything, and so it was great, one, simply because it was Oxford, but also because the British and the non-U.S. Rhodes Scholars had all returned. So here we had this cut of experienced soldiers and naval officers and Air Force types from the Commonwealth, and our own American friends. My tutor and I was assigned a new college, and my tutor was the great Alan Bullock, the European historian, who was finishing then his biography of Hitler, the Study in Tyranny, or A Study in Tyranny. So this was a very exciting period to be there and to have tutors of this caliber and be exposed to all the wonders of of Oxford and all that, that means, and to do it in the company of an old undergraduate friend. So, I guess I came home finally in February or March of 46. After a certain amount of shilly-shallying and fancying that maybe I wanted to go to Yale and all this sort of thing, I jumped all of that and re-enrolled in the UW Law School.
Tell me what led you from your earlier undergraduate work to an interest in law.
Well, American institutions, you know, is very closely aligned.
That
major was a selected major in three social studies disciplines, and mine were history, American history, economics, and political science. So I think I recognized that I was not scholarly enough to pursue a PhD the way Leon did at the University of Chicago, but that my sense of things and so on was that the best applied graduate work in the social studies at that juncture was the law. And my interest was in public law, and we had very good people on the faculty. So I don't really regret that. We now, you know, have other programs and other degrees, but then it seemed to be the most sensible thing to do. And I met my wife, who was a graduate student in English. Part of the original staff of Integrated Liberal Studies.
Oh.
She and...
what's her name?
Her name was Elizabeth Eshelman, E-S-H-L-E-M-A-N. And her mother's, in part, they were Southerners. Part of her mother's family and so on was out of Memphis. Law school, good. Again, all of these old friends were around, like Matt Effernan.
He was,
of
course, in law.
Yeah. And John Wickham from Janesville, a former Wisconsin, the justice's son, who still practices in Janesville. And I remember John and I won the moot court competition, which is the activity in the law school. I think Matt Heffernan and John Reynolds were our opponents. Nothing too exciting at this period, except that having returned in 46, I really returned for the demise of the Progressive Party. I was up at Portage on that sad day when the party finally folded its tent, that's where the convention was, and decided, foolishly I guess, because Bob wanted it that way, that we would go back into the Republican Party. So the Follets were prepared to cooperate with Democrats, Roosevelt Democrats, but they could never really accept being Democrats, because and this is woven into the La Follette family mythology because of how dreadfully Wilson and his people had treated the old man in the period of the First War and so on. It just couldn't accept that. Well, of course, it didn't work. Bob lost the election to Joe McCarthy in 1946. But I had some friends who followed the course. Gaylord did, and he was a Republican for a while. Tom Fairchild, who just retired as Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, was in that crowd. But as I say, that didn't last long, because it was kind of excitement, political excitement locally, as we returned from the war. After graduation, my first assignment, my first job, was as Assistant United States Attorney here in Madison for the Western District of Wisconsin, and that runs from Lake Superior to Rock County. and I followed Jim Doyle, who had come back from Washington 2 years before and had been assistant United States attorney.
How did that come about?
Doyle?
No, your...
My appointment? Well, there, aside from such competence as I could seemingly deliver, Bob Tien, who was then state Democratic chairman and a very sophisticated guy, later United States District Judge, was leader of the Democrats in the legislature, state senator. And he was convinced that the Democratic Party had to open up avenues, make room for the La Follette, the young La Follette progressives, who really, you know, didn't have a home. So he was the arranger, because that's a patronage kind of appointment. And Mr. Truman was president, and Tom Clark was attorney general, and I was appointed. No experience, but thrown right into the mill. We had one assistant in the office, and of course you have all the federal criminal matters and civil matters. And my really first significant case was to finish the brief that Doyle had started and to argue the case in the United States Court of Appeals in the Seventh Circuit. Well, you know, there are a lot of lawyers who never get a court at that level in their whole career. There I was.
Just starting out there.
Yeah. Won the case, too. Carried the case in the Court of Appeals and later sustained in the Supreme Court. So this was, again, you know, challenging, exciting business, even though I was sure I knew what I was doing a good share of the time. But I was thrown into this Democratic den, and one has to put this carefully so you aren't misunderstood, but appreciate that the Democratic Party in Wisconsin, up until this post-war point, 48, about, was the province, and had been historically, ever since progressives pulled off the liberal community in the state, the old Democratic Party was an Irish Catholic domain, like it was in the cities in the East, but this extended over the entire state, because Wisconsin progressivism, La Folletism, was very, I wouldn't say waspish in the usual social sense, but it was German and Scandinavian and highly Protestant. And the Democrats, small in number and terribly conservative, were the old traditional Irish Catholics. I think I was the only Protestant in the federal courthouse.
But
Tien, you see, knew what he was about, because he was building for the future. In other words, to broaden the base of the Democratic Party with the old La Follette progressives. And so there I landed resumed the political faith of my grandfather, and have been there ever since, with no regrets.
Well, I know you did that for about 3 years, and
yeah,
then you joined the university faculty.
That's right.
How did that come about?
Well, I was invited back by Oliver Rundle, who was dean then, to help with some of the sort of practical programs. Supposedly my career downtown had prepared me for, only in part because our practical programs in the law school are really designed to train young practitioners for the state, and the federal practice is a little off the course of that. But I enjoyed those 3 years because I got to know really quite intimately all of the western side of the state. my older associations have been the eastern side of the state, but this new venture took me to Superior and Wausau and La Crosse and Eau Claire and up and down the west. So I joined the law faculty as a young assistant professor in 51. Wonderful faculty, older faculty, Oliver Rundle and Ray Brown, Bill Rice, Nate Feinsinger, and some very good younger people that came in, most of whom are now gone, gone other places, like Auerbach, who became dean at Minnesota. Hurst is now retired. Heflin went west for his health. He went to Arizona. So forth. But it was still a relatively small faculty. They were just carrying enormous loads in terms of students and class size and so on. But it was an exposure to what the university faculty must have been like pre-war, in a sense. And Rundle himself, not a very flashy figure, but a very wise man. E.B. Fred, I think, sort of pushed Rundle into retirement like he did Dr. Middleton at the medical school. I guess, in Fred's notion, they weren't interested enough in research. Probably true, except that in the process he bought a lot of trouble, particularly in the medical school, which has been going on ever since.
Yes, they've had dean after dean after dean.
Yeah, and vice chancellors and under chancellors, and, you know.
Yeah.
This stuff. Well, so on the outside, and I was married when I left law school, my wife was a political activist as well. Along came 1952 and the opportunity to redress the ghastly error of 1946. And I've forgotten who had the idea. Whether it was Macmillan, Miles, probably, and Maury Rubin, were old La Follette types, you know, and had worked for the La Follettes and all this stuff. And Evu and the Capital Times were hand in glove with the La Follettes. To try to pave the way for the defeat of McCarthy, we organized a small committee called the Committee on McCarthy's Record. Have you ever seen that book we did?
No, but I know there was an investigation.
Well, it really was. Well, this was our own effort at political pamphleteering. Macmillan and Rubin wrote most of the copy. Wickham, John Wickham, who practices in Janesville, and I edited it in legal terms. And the committee had on it, the senior member, I guess, was old Clough Gates from Superior, who had been sometime university regent, and was the second man in command on the paper up in Superior. Wonderful old lady, a Vassar type, and a wealthy maiden lady from Janesville named Jeffries, John Wickham, my wife and myself, Reuben Macmillan, and Norman Clapp, who had been Bob La Follette's last administrative assistant. And in these later years, you know, he was public service commissioner here, secretary of transportation, all of this. And was living in Wisconsin, running the newspaper down at Lancaster. Well, we published the McCarthy Record, and somewhere you must get a copy of this in hand. I'll dig one up so you can see what.
Oh, I'd be very interested in it.
It was pamphleteering, debunking and criticizing and exposing Joe McCarthy, you know, the political reprobate.
Wasn't there some sort of court matter that he was involved in?
Well, he had been a judge, you know, himself. And there was some litigation. We weren't involved in any of that. But what we did to carry our political message was to run off draft printed copies of this publication, which was got a Reader's Digest format, and took it around the state to influential people to endorse. And we had some mighty fine endorsements, including my dean, Oliver Rundle. I guess I didn't appreciate at the time how risky this was for someone who didn't have academic tenure. I was ignorant enough to...
Which you didn't have at that
which
time.
Which I didn't have, you see, which I didn't... I don't know if I really cared that much. Probably didn't. But nonetheless, it was kind of a risky venture for an assistant professor. But, and I'm sure Oliver, in part, may have had that in mind when he gave his endorsement. One of the endorsers came out of that all very well. And Charlie Bunn was an endorser. And physicians and lawyers and business leaders, clergymen, all around the state. We did two things then. We sold the publication for $1 a copy and had several press runs and sold, we sold about 100,000 copies.
That's a lot.
Yeah, for political pamphleteering. And the Milwaukee Journal, the Capital Times, and the Sheboygan Press, which was an old-line Democratic paper. Matt Werner, many years a regent, was head of the Sheboygan Press. And they ran it, with our permission, serially, in three major metropolitan papers.
Around the country?
No.
Or just in the state?
In the state. And then the election laws weren't as tight in those days. We made money on it. And we sluiced the profits from the operation into Tom Fairchild's campaign, who was a candidate. Attracted quite a bit of interest and outside interest as well, including the lady who was a widow, publisher of the New York Herald Tribune. What was her name? She was originally from Appleton.
You don't mean Sona Gale, do you?
No. What is that family's name of the old New York Herald Tribune?
Great, I don't know.
Well, at any rate, she was, and she would call me once a week to see how the campaign was going. My last conversation with her was to tell her that it was all over, that her candidate, Dwight Eisenhower, had endorsed McCarthy off the back of the train in Appleton. You see, the heat was put on Eisenhower by such worthies in Wisconsin as Walter Kohler, who should have known better. But Kohler was not known for his courage.
No, he wasn't.
And McCarthy was endorsed by Eisenhower, and of course won, but he ran at the bottom of the ticket. Not sure that if Eisenhower had not endorsed him, we might have beaten him. It was a tough fight. So, in terms of McCarthy and those of us in this venture, he never really attacked us. He was very shrewd. He didn't attack the University of Wisconsin and its people.
I've been told that. No, I was.
And so we kind of skated through, you see. Yeah. On the other hand, his henchmen, my mother was widowed and living in our little hometown, she caught more heat than I did from the McCarthy followers. And they were a tough bunch. No one could think otherwise. This was the saloon element in these small towns, the toughies, who saw McCarthy just the kind of bully boy that delighted them. And to get their licks in in my mother's case, you see, a small town establishment type, that gave them great satisfaction. Now, if McCarthy had been a skillful political organizer, in addition to being a very skillful media operator, could have been even worse. Joe really didn't care very much about political organization, and he really, I don't think, bore any particular animus to his enemies and so on. While he'd give Ed Bailey or Miles McMillan going over and so on, there was always a fair amount of humor. And if he wasn't drunk, see, it wasn't all that bad. His adherents, his followers, were much uglier.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God he didn't have that capacity. So that when eventually, you see, he turned on Eisenhower, the Eisenhower administration, Eisenhower was kind of dumbstruck with this and didn't quite know how to react. And I had no pity for him. Brought it on himself. And eventually, after that Army McCarthy hearing and his kind of national television exposure and the booze, started to get the better of him, and then eventually Lyndon, who had become majority leader, was he majority leader that early? I think so, but still very much the man of Senator Russell. When Senator Russell concluded that Joe McCarthy had really impugned the honor of the Senate, so that was the signal for Lyndon and the good Republicans, some of the New England Republican senators, to move in on McCarthy and deliver. Well, what did they do? Yeah. Activities.
Do you want to talk about some of your activities?
Well,
about that
I don't
time?
Think in that era, as a young assistant professor, that there was very much that was exciting. Though relatively early on, I've forgotten quite when, I became assistant dean of the law school and picked up a lot of the routine administrative responsibilities.
Well, my records say it was 1953.
Yeah, okay. We're just about there. The law school had always run on an understaffed basis. They had a dean, and they had wonderful civil service people that carried the workload. And even then, I think the chief staff assistant was Nellie Davidson, who retired only just a few years ago, who understood this institution administratively from top to bottom, and could keep almost any damn fool from doing anything very outrageous, because she'd catch you in time. You know, one of these wonderful people that in fact keep the place going smoothly and effectively. But I enjoyed that role because I handled students and student placement, student admissions, and I...
So this is job placement you're talking
about? Yeah, and alumni affairs, you know, the things that the dean didn't want to worry about too much, so that he could concentrate on faculty recruitment and so on.
How was the job placement situation at that time?
It was pretty good. Pretty good. The state's economy was building, and law firms were building up from their wartime levels, though there was some interval of time. But, you know, there's always a turnover, and people were building staffs, and as federal and state legislation impose new requirements, new programs, business for lawyers increases, and it was pretty good. And I always found getting to know these young people coming in who were admitted and the good graduates going out to be interesting and exciting and kind of challenging, particularly when you could get a first rate, or if not absolute top dog, but a very good student, not to go to Chicago or New York, but in fact to go to a county seat in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. This was desired.
Well, it was desired on my part, and it's that level, you see, the kids that were coming out in the 50s. Now, who are the circuit judges around the state? And in the law, as in elected politics and so on, there's no real substitute for quality. And we saw it as our mission, particularly a man like Rundle, to see to it that wherever we could, we would try to bring that about. So that we get a good student, you know, going to Antigo, or Chippewa Falls, or Phillips, or wherever it might be. So, even today, as I venture around the state, or have some activity afoot, I tend to know a good number of these people that, not well, but, you know, I have an old association with them. I don't think in that early era that I was active on any university committees, except as kind of sub-administrative committees that, you know, operate counterparts in letters and science and medicine and education and so on.
Well, I have a note mentioning something called an occupational deferment committee. What was that?
I guess that must have operated, what, during the Korean War? I really don't remember much about it, and I don't think it was of great significance. It must have been either a committee that exercised judgment on cases in which people wanted selective service deferments based on the criticality of their work. Now, whether we handled faculty in that, I honestly don't remember. But mm-hmm. I don't recall it as being of great import.
Okay. I also have a note that you were on the Union Council in about 1953.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, this was, you know, a carryover from student days, and dear old Porter Butts was still very much in control.
Oh, he was until not terribly long ago.
Until about 6 months. Ted Crabb wouldn't like that, but Porter was one of those interesting figures in this place. The non-faculty, well, some of them were faculty, he was too, actually, who built their empires within, or their principalities within the empire. The other counterpart to Porter Butts was Harold McCarty over at WHA.
Oh, yes, I know.
And you see, you build these things, and then you organize something called Friends Of. And you raise a little money on the side, and you have all this paraphernalia, and pretty soon you're a force to be reckoned with by the chancellor or the president. Someone ought to do a little sub-study sometimes of principalities within the kingdom.
It could be very interesting.
The academic world, you see.
I've done an interview with Porter, Bob.
And Porter was a master, absolute master. He never gave up. He never liked the French. He never forgot. He didn't learn too much either, but he never forgot. And Porter and I were always kind of friends, but Porter never felt that I was really tight, close enough. I would deviate sometimes. You gotta watch fellas like that. They cause you trouble.
Can't count on them for
Can't
sure.
Always, you see.
Yeah.
Always. You know, the Union Council students and faculty and alumni and so on. I guess I must have held a faculty seat. Well, I'm not sure which. But
good fun, and the union has always been essentially well run, and much of it bears Porter's imprimatur. And while he could be at times a consummate bore to deal with, his record is really an outstanding one. I'm still on the union. You know, they have a two-layered structure. They have at the upper echelon the Wisconsin Union Corporation, which Lowell Frautzy headed for many years. Now, who did he turn it over to? The new chairman. But anyhow, they have two levels of members: general members and voting members. Well, I've been now for some time a non-voting member, but I never was lifted to that exalted status of being a voting trustee.
What do you
trustee.
Have to be a voting member?
Steady.
Who decides?
Well, the voting members, I think, bring new voting members to their ranks. It's self-perpetuating.
But they choose them.
Yes, yes. And obviously, over for many years with the confidential counsel of Porter.
That figures.
But, as I say, you know, I like Harold McCarty, who built that state radio operation, can be terribly annoying and troubling to administrators. It isn't as if he didn't build a quality product in the process. Absolute dedication. Of course, Harold sort of got thrown off the track because he thought that FM radio was the future, and he didn't really envisage TV coming on the way it did. And when Lee Dreyfus was here...
As a student, you mean?
As a faculty member.
Or as faculty.
In the 60s. It was his head-on encounters with Harold McCarty, who was his superior, that kept things lively in the communications field.
I can imagine that would have been lively.
And I got to know Lee, and this is jumping ahead of the story, but just to say that quite well in that era, because we were in the process of expanding through the coordinating committee. We were expanding the TV outlets around the state, moving out from the Madison base. Well, let's see, where are we? We're somewhere in the mid-50s.
Well, early on. We're talking about the Union Council.
Yeah.
Well, there are various other things that I found you did, like being Secretary Treasurer of the Wisconsin Law Alumni Association.
Yeah, that was part of really being
the
assistant
dean.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That sort of came with.
Folded into that.
Well, something that really hasn't, and maybe we should get into before we go on to continue with your academic activities. I'd like to pick up on your involvement with ROTC, I think, and sort of follow that through the years.
All right, though we'll get a little out of sequence.
That's all right. We'll come back to this other. I think it would make more sense to just stick with
because,
that. And
because
see.
I want to talk about the National Security Studies Group.
Well, that could sort of come in with that. Because, well,
though
or you put that
separate.
Under your teaching, yes.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that.
Yes. Oh, I want to talk about that, too.
Yeah. The... by the way, Dick was involved with us a bit in all of that.
Well, tell me about it when you get to it.
Relatively early on, I think there was an ROTC faculty committee, which performed in sort of perfunctory manner, because the programs, particularly through the the years in which, the Korean War years and so on, there wasn't any problem really of recruiting. We had three strong programs of the three services, and they operated rather independently, as they still do in most places, independent of the university community, and gave their students kind of straightforward military subject training, commissioned them, and sent them off. And I'm a little sketchy on, in recollection on when, at what point we made the first effort, but it was late 50s, the first effort to reorganize the curriculum. Mm-hmm. It was our position, and I think we had nominal interest and support from the front office. Let's see, EB must have been. He was president until Elvian took over for that short period. So I think EB Fred must have been president. We generated a somewhat stronger faculty committee. Mind you, the colonels and so on, the naval captain, were all are, and then were members, to see if we couldn't integrate the military curriculum with the general university curriculum. And it meant the reshuffling of units of instruction, taking the clearly military side of it either out of the program and leaving it for non-credit instruction or to be done in summer camps, but to build into the program coursework for these cadets, and it varied depending on the service. And we had the greatest success with the Army because the Army was open-minded about this.
You're inferring that the Navy was less so.
Navy was less so. Air Force, somewhere in between. Though the Air Force, which as a profession, as a service, was very weak in terms of college-educated officers.
Oh, it was.
See, it had been drawn out of the Army and greatly expanded, and you had all sorts of young people who were fine pilots and officers during the war and so on, who had only some college education or none, very few with graduate degrees. So that because these people tended to stay in the old Army, and the Air Force had never had much of an input or a crossover of talent from the Navy because the Navy had their own flying machines. But the Army had people then in higher ranks, kind of intellectual types, sort of like Jim Gavin or Maxwell Taylor, people of this caliber, who recognized the importance of education and graduate education to the future of the officer corps and the service. So they were prepared to listen, you see, that we would substitute for some of their instruction a course in kind of geopolitical considerations. They were prepared to give up attempting to teach military history out of a handbook and have a legitimate historian. And one of the appointments we made in the late 50s was Kaufman in the Department of History, who was brought here as a military historian, and a very good one he is, but to teach, among other things, military history to the ROTC program. And there were substitutions in the
don't know if in the hard science area, eventually they were for the Navy. But substitutions in sort of management skills and stuff that the Air Force was interested in, things that the business school could offer, and courses in political science. And we had, and this is where you get some overlap now with my national security studies effort, you had people like Bernie Cohen. Yeah.
There.
Oh. Do you want to turn it over? Do you?
No, it's all set.
Oh, it's all set. A series of substitutions, either courses that were on the books, some courses were in fact generated for this particular purpose, and we didn't limit those courses, if we either old courses or new courses, just to cadets, but they would, the cadets would be in there mixed with the regular undergraduate students. And it almost immediately put a different light on the ROTC programs and the faculty's reaction. These were no longer something we just suffered and carried on the fringes because we had some kind of statutory obligation to do it, but that the training of professional officers in fact became part of the university mission, and a good share of the credits being taught were being taught by our normal civil faculty colleagues.
Now, you mentioned cadets. Did they come as under special arrangements?
No.
Or were they regularly enrolled students?
Well, they were regularly enrolled students. And I think in those years we didn't offer any of the scholarships and so on that are now involved. So this became kind of the Wisconsin experiment in officer training. And it was good, obviously, for the students, for the cadets themselves, good for the services, and good for the university community at large. So that, as I said, it wasn't us and them, but a much closer integration evolved. And I think the commandants and so on who were here in that period appreciated it, being a part of the effort. And it had some spillover, some effect in other institutions, but never as great as it should have been, because, you see, we were spending appropriated university dollars to a much greater degree in relationship to the ROTC programs than, say, University XYZ or somewhere else, because the military was paying for it all.
But the military wasn't paying for this.
No, they didn't. They didn't pay as such. These courses were offered at the expense of whatever college had the offering. But we felt it as a part of our obligation that if we were going to have the programs, and the state wanted us to have the programs, that we wanted to do the very best we could for all concerned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and no matter kind of a pro bono publico approach, and which is kind of typical of this grand old institution. You know, when they face up to something like this, they do it well. And I was active all through this period, going off to the meetings in the Naval Schools and ROTC, and visiting the kids in summer camp, and doing quite a bit of kind of extra committee work in the interest of the programs. And I was obviously interested because I was active again active all through the 50s with the Wisconsin National Guard, the 32nd Division, which I signed up with in 46, and eventually, and most of that period, I was the General Staff Officer for Logistics. At the end of the line, I was commanding the logistical units of the division. So
And that was my own personal military side. So I was involved in military activity, soldier, university ROTC committee, and with the Academic National Security Studies program.
Yeah, we'll go into detail more next time.
Right, I wonder if this might not be a point of termination so I can talk to Rogotsky.